Menders, Episode 30, Healing Burnout and Moral Injury Through Radical Community with Dr. Dave Kopasz. This is the season finale for Menders Season 1. My conversation with Dave was one of the most popular episodes of this first season. Thank you so much for your support. And I can't think of a better way to prepare for Season 2, Women in Leadership, which will drop in January. Stay tuned.
It's an individual problem, but it's interesting. If you go back and read Maslach's work, her early work was, this is an issue of a relationship between an individual and an organization. This is an organizational work issue. It's not an individual issue.
You're listening to Menders with clinical psychologist and leadership consultant, Dr. Nicola DePaul. Each week, get a dose of real-world inspiration from free-thinking leaders, top clinicians, healthcare innovators, and myself. Looking for quick fixes or standard management tools? Try someplace else. Motivated to maximize the resilience and diversity of your team, sustain your momentum as a leader, and transform your healthcare system? Welcome to Menders. Well, welcome. We have Dr. Dave Kopasz today, and you're an integrative medicine and psychiatric physician working in the public sector. And you and I have actually worked together for quite a few years, mostly pre-pandemic, and I have a lot of respect for you as a clinician and as a fellow provider. So I'm so grateful to be taking the time to sit down together today. So thank you.
Thanks, Nicola. It's great to catch up with you.
So I invited you here to talk with me a bit about what physicians are experiencing in terms of both burnout and moral injury, and also how we can start to think about what can systems or organizations do differently to create a healthier environment so that people don't continue to burn out. So, but before we get into that, I'd actually just love to have you briefly introduce yourself and share a little bit about your work. And you're also a published author, and you have some books out looking at these same issues. So I'd love to just hear a little bit about that and then go from there.
Yeah, I've been interested in this topic for a long time. Self-care and holistic medicine, integrative medicine do kind of go hand in hand. The first project that I worked on as a medical student research project was on a paper looking at post-traumatic stress disorder symptoms in relationship to internship year. So even as a, you know, first and second year medical student, I was learning that being a doctor has its costs. I call it the costs of caring. So there's these costs of caring that we have, like burnout and compassion fatigue, and even things like post-traumatic stress disorder from our work. And so in a way, a lot of my career, it's almost like this kind of undercurrent of my career is figuring out how can we support the full humanity of physicians and healthcare workers in institutional settings. There's this intrinsic element of burnout that we have just from our jobs. You know, we're working with death and illness and madness and trauma, and that could cause burnout just in and of itself. And yet we're working in institutions that sometimes are at cross purposes for us being able to be healers with people and to give them exactly what they need. And so then you have these extrinsic elements as well from the institution that can amplify the intrinsic burnout that we have from our work. So it's a really complicated thing. And so much of the focus has been on self-care, looking at that almost like a deficit model that clinicians have, if they just had better time management skills, or if they just did more yoga or meditation. This is generally, you know, on your own time. If you did this resilience building stuff on your own time, you wouldn't ever burn out. You know, as you know, more and more we're looking at institutional issues that predispose people to burnout. So I really like the direction, many even coming out of Mayo Clinic, and a lot of the stuff out of the Harvard Business Review lately is saying, you know, don't think about burnout as an individual problem. Think of it as an institutional and organizational issue.
I'm just laughing, and I love that you said that and are emphasizing how much burnout's organizational, because I identify with that clinician who is kind of the poster child for if you could do it all yourself, you wouldn't burn out, because I definitely burned out. And at the same time, I was practicing mindfulness and yoga and biking every day. And if, you know, if those beautiful health behaviors are not enough to keep you from burning out, like, you know, it's obviously it's not a personal problem. What is it about how our systems are functioning that are really creating this systemic level of burnout? And so I guess just to back up a little bit, I read a 2019 stat that was quoting or that was saying about 50% of physicians are experiencing burnout. And I think it was like 15 to 20% of physicians met full criteria for post-traumatic stress disorder. And, you know, the highest profession, and that's actually a bit above what you would typically see with a combat veteran population. So why do you think this is happening for physicians?
It's a good question. There's a Thich Nhat Hanh quote about, engaged Buddhism, like during the Vietnam War, when Thich Nhat Hanh developed this idea of engaged Buddhism, which is compassion in action. And he said that if they didn't have the spiritual component, people would burn out. And so in order to put compassion into action, Thich Nhat Hanh anyway said we need a spiritual component. So in healthcare, sometimes I wonder, you know, the fact that we're just our systems are designed in these economic ways that look at productivity. They look at things as if we were on an assembly line producing something. They don't, the institution doesn't look at, you know, these are multidimensional human beings who have, you know, a spiritual dimension. And the patients are also multidimensional beings who have a spiritual dimension. How can we support that? So I really wonder sometimes if we could develop a system, a way of some type of spiritual practice. And I think in a way, we're kind of trying to go that way, where unconsciously we're going towards meditation and yoga, these traditions that have ancient spiritual roots. And we're turning to those to try and say, well, we need to build a better well-being. The problem is we look at it from an individualistic perspective rather than a collectivist perspective. So the other thing Thich Nhat Hanh said is, you know, we all support each other. And so there, he developed the sangha of, what did he call it? I think interbeing, the order of interbeing. And then that idea too of interbeing is, you know, we're all in this together. We're all interconnected. So, and that's the very antithesis of, you need to go home and work out and ride your bike and eat better and do all these things. There's a study by West in 2020 on physicians, and it showed that physicians have higher rates of resilience than the average population, and yet they have higher rates of burnout. And when I saw that, I was like, ah, you know, that's this thing I've been feeling of like people just, and like sometimes organizations don't want to talk about burnout. They're like, that's too negative. Let's talk about resilience. And that it almost feels like this kind of gaslighting thing or this kind of blame the victim thing of.
Hey, if you're listening to this and you're not sure how to get started to address burnout and create a culture of well-being in your organization, or you've been working on this for a while, but you're not quite happy with how things are going, and you're looking for a roadmap and someone to support your team through this process, listen up, because this is for you. Investing in your people is the smartest thing your healthcare system can do. Whether you have a tiny system or a large complex department, there are focused actions you can take to transform your organizational culture from burnout to well-being. Head over to Mending Health Systems and join me now. I work with leadership teams to simplify and demystify this process so that you can feel really good about the efforts you're putting out in the world and so confident that your investments in employee engagement and team well-being will pay dividends. I will make this process so much easier for you, I promise. Head on over to mendinghealthsystems.com and join me today.
If we can get you to build more resilience, we don't have to change the organization. So I don't know if that answered your question, but those are some of the thoughts I've had about, is there a way we can sort of re-spiritualize medicine to bring in that element and dimension? Because then I'm sure you've had situations where you've interacted with somebody and it's been very emotionally draining. And yet you feel somehow you come out of it like, I really connected to that person. I really helped that person. And then there's situations, you know, that we feel at work sometimes of like, yeah, I did really just kind of triage this person off to somebody else. And it could feel like I didn't care. Because I said the way the system's set up, I'm sorry, I can be a caring person for like 20 to 25 minutes. And you've got me for this long. And then after that, you know, somebody else is going to have to care for you.
Yeah. Or you might continue to care for that person, but it's technically against the rules.
Yeah, right, right.
Yeah, I run into that. I guess that is just, it's really consistent with some of my experiences. I think the most powerful patient experiences that I have as a clinician are when I feel that, like, the very human connection. Or, a patient I was talking with earlier today, we were really focusing on how to apply self-compassion, like how to bring acceptance of, you know, this person's humanity into everyday life and then start to transform their relationships with other people. And it was pretty simple conversation, but also really human and very beautiful and meaningful for me. But you know, that is not necessarily something that is easy to code, or something that is prioritized in terms of how we spend our time with patients. So, I mean, how do you start to change the system's approach or create space where those kinds of interactions are really prioritized? And maybe to give an example, so within my discipline, I'm a clinical psychologist. Evidence-based practices are really important, and you know, everything is moving towards evidence-based practice, and I am a firm believer in evidence-based practice. But what the research, my reading of the research really shows is that at the heart of all interactions, the most change in a patient's outcomes comes out of the connection and relationship with the therapist. So if you're missing that, then that evidence-based practice is not going to get you anywhere. But a lot of the emphasis that I see is kind of to sort of forget about those human or relationship factors and sort of think of the evidence-based component as a replacement when it's really not. But I kind of feel that may be happening on a systemic level too.
I think so. And you know, that was my first book was Rehumanizing Medicine. And so when I looked at, well, what are the dehumanizing elements of medicine? One of them is an overly biological reductionist approach towards working with individuals. Another is the economic systems that we set up that look at, rather than human suffering, we look at how we can code things and bill things. So I've developed this idea of looking at technicians and healers. You know, there's a technician is somebody who is highly skilled at doing the same thing over and over again, the same way with anybody, regardless of who the other person is. A healer is very subjective and individualized. And a healer is going to know, do I go fast with this person? Do I go slow? Does this person respond to professional kind of authority, or are they going to get triggered by that and be very mistrustful if someone says, well, you know, I'm an expert and I know what to do. And so other people will, if you are too collaborative, they're like, well, you're the doctor. Why are you asking me what to do? So, you know, being able to adjust to fit the treatment to the person is more of being a healer, whereas a technician is like, this is the way we do it, and how do you fit? You know, how do we fit you into our system? So evidence-based models are very good. They train us to be good technicians. They don't train us to be good people or good healers. And so sometimes what I think is, in addition to evidence-based practices, we need human-based practices. And in addition to continuing professional education, we need continuing human education. So the research does show, like you mentioned, common factors, common variables, all those things that come out of psychotherapy that say the humanity and the interpersonal connection is more of a stronger variable than the type of technique that you're using. Another thing is compassionomics. Have you read that book by Trezak and Mazzarelli?
No.
Yeah. Stephen Trezak and Anthony Mazzarelli. Put in a plug for their book. So compassionomics, it's not compassionomics, but more like genomics. So compassionomics, and they review like 1,000 research papers and all these different things. They weren't like touchy-feely people to begin with. They're more, you know, kind of scientist people. But anyway, they, after doing all this work, they're like, compassion is an evidence-based practice. And it works for patients and patient outcomes, and it works for providers and provider wellness. So there's this research, but for some reason, the institutions, you know, they're structured based on these things you can count and measure. And science is based on things you can count and measure, and evidence-based practices are based on things you can count and measure. And yet the spiritual, the human, the existential, these different things are things that are qualitative, not quantitative. They're things that you can't count and measure. And traditionally, you had professionalism. Our level of professionalism would be the foundation, and then the techniques were on top of it. But what we've done is we've created the reverse, where our techniques are our foundation, and then this stuff on top is the optional. So, and the more you give of these things, everybody's still doing this technical work, the same technical work, but then the person who's like, but I'm going to try and be compassionate, that you're doing that almost like unpaid. And so Danielle Ofri wrote in New York Times Magazine that institutions are taking advantage of doctors and nurses' professionalism, because they know that at the end of the day, we're always going to give a little extra. So they don't have to budget in. Where's the compassion time in the interaction? You know, whereas a lawyer would be like, you know, I'm billing you. I have 15 minutes longer. You get billed for 15 minutes. With a doctor, you get billed for the procedure code. So a technician doctor could spend, you know, 5 minutes and bill that code. A healer doctor could spend 25 minutes and bill that code. And they both look equally productive, except one put in 20 more minutes.
I mean, how do you think we can start to change that or shift that?
It comes down to that. I mean, in a way, Parker Palmer says institutions are us. You know, if we just say, well, we can't change anything because it's the institution. Institutions are creations of people. So they are us. But at the same time, most of us, you know, the large number of people in an institution, healthcare institution, are employees. And then you've got the level of management up above. So with a whole health perspective, you know, kind of what the VA does is they talk about whole health and cultural transformation. There, if that was really applied, you'd have cultural transformation at each level. So we could call it whole health or a holistic view of people's human needs. We could also call it caring. So for these purposes, let's call it caring. The patients come in, they need care. The clinicians care for the patients. The leadership is caring for the clinicians so that they can better care for the patients. Kind of a trickle-down thing, so that the whole system is based on care. Rather than, I think what happens a lot of times, leadership is looking at metrics and clinicians are talking care. And so there's really two languages. Like Jerry Arbuckle is a Catholic priest and anthropologist, cultural anthropologist. And so he wrote a book called Rehumanizing Medical Reforms. And he was a healthcare consultant and did a lot of different work and came at it as an anthropologist. So he came up with five different subcultures within medicine. And that a lot of the problems in medicine are basically you've got management is in one culture and clinicians are in another culture. And then he's got, kind of there's like a culture of caring, a culture of biological medicine, a culture of economics. And these are three different cultures that have three different sets of values. And so what happens a lot of times is the system has one set of values, and then you're trying to work in a system from a compassion perspective. But if it's an economic culture that you're working in, then you're always going to be kind of at cross purposes, and you're always going to be trying to sneak in compassion rather than compassion being built into your work.
I mean, I definitely feel that, like with my same day patient example, I mean, I did go over time.
So how do you change the system? I mean, the whole pandemic, I have been another level of kind of agonizing for me is this is kind of my expertise. It's one of my things that I look at of, clinician wellness is one of the things that I'm fairly, I don't know if I'd say expert in, but I think about a lot. I study a lot. I do lectures on it and things like that. And yet I thought, even for myself, I can't implement these things. And then I thought of all these different things I could kind of do on my own initiative to try and take on top of everything else to say, how can I help my team? How can I help other people? Like writing, that's one way. And, I co-authored a chapter on clinician resilience with Greg Serpa that's going to come out in the Integrative Medicine 5th edition textbook. So that's coming out. So you can do things like that, but I felt I wasn't doing enough. Shouldn't I be like trying to get everybody to get together for meditation or something? And but then again, it's this kind of strong worker fallacy or this kind of self-care fallacy. And so on the one hand, I feel like I've got all these ideas and knowledge and research base, and yet I'm kind of flummoxed of like, how do you implement it? Like, unless you have institutional support and leadership support to kind of, do this, then it becomes something that you're doing as voluntary collateral duty on top of everything else that you're doing. And then again, that's back to Danielle Ofri's thing of, institutions are taking care of professionals' compassion and professionalism because they know, oh, well, you'll do that on top of everything else.
Yeah, I started to develop a like clinician resilience program maybe 6 or 8 months ago, and I started to talk with clinician friends of mine and coworkers and people, and I realized that while what I was, I think what I was going to offer, which was like self-compassion based, probably would be a powerful intervention, people just did not feel like they had the bandwidth to add something additional in. So at some point, even if you offer, maybe if you offered someone buyout of their clinic grid time, that might make a difference. But at some point, it's like those person-specific, even very healthy sorts of things just don't seem to add value and don't feel helpful. And what I've heard as the alternative, from some of the nurses who I've talked to in particular, they're like, we don't need, any of that kind of thing. We also really don't need more pizza parties, like enough. But what we really need is another nurse. What we really need is to feel like our staffing ratios are safe. We need the appropriate amount of time to administer the appropriate medications. Or, we need another nurse so that somebody can make the phone calls and check in with the patients who are high risk or who are struggling, and then somebody else can check out the patients or deal with the blood pressure in the clinic. And it's just been really interesting because those are, in some ways, just completely logistical things. But the people I've been talking to just feel like those are things that would improve their well-being dramatically and create a work environment that felt much more supported. And much more supportive of them as clinicians. So I mean, what do you think about those kinds of just very basic needs that people seem to have?
The examples you gave, I was trying to listen to them. Maybe all of them wouldn't cost money, but I think most of them would cost money. We need another nurse. That means, hiring another nurse or bringing another nurse in. They're logistical issues, but they're things that would cost the institution to support their staff. So there are things, well, this is a cost as well. Like, where I work recently, they just said no more noon meetings, mandatory noon meetings. And I was like, that makes so much sense. Why were we doing mandatory noon meetings to start with? And why are we starting work 5 minutes early every day, for this mandatory meeting? Because that time adds up. That's time that you, because you're a professional, you're expected to like give up your lunch one day a week, but even that, then what that means is we're going to do that meeting at a different time of the day, and that's going to come out of productivity time rather than out of, lunch time. I mean, one thing, I was impressed with this article I just read by Michelle Barton and her colleagues, Stop Framing Wellness Programs Around Self-Care in Harvard Business Review. And there's just a nice piece that I thought kind of sums up the shift that we need to do. So rather than focusing on self-care, we need to be better at taking care of each other. And so this begins by framing employee distress as a collective rather than individual problem. It then entails creating and fostering what we call relational pauses. So this idea of relational pauses, I kind of take that to mean we need to build the human back into the environment. We need to build the emotional back into the environment. We need to stop in what we're doing and create space for us to breathe, to grieve, to connect. But again, where does that space come out of? If it comes out of your lunch hour, well, people are going to be like, can't do three things in my lunch hour, be in a mandatory meeting and my lunch and, try and do relational pausing. But if the leadership, I think this really goes to a shift in leadership, that leadership has to see compassion's not something that's nice to add on, or, emotional intelligence and emotional relating is not something nice to add on to leadership skills. It's really the foundation. And if businesses want to retain talent, they're going to have to invest time and money and energy in caring for people. Tony Schwartz has a book called The Way We're Working Isn't Working. I love the title of that book. I think it's like 2010. He's like a business consultant. And so he has this in the book. He says, people come to us, managers, CEOs, they come to us and they say, how can we get more out of our people? And he says, you're asking the wrong question. What you should be asking is, how can we fuel and nourish and support the full humanity of our employees so they are happy and nurtured and want to bring the best of themselves to work? So it's really kind of like, a lot of times we've got the cart before the horse, and we're trying to push the cart from behind instead of, if there was something that the horse wanted to go to, it would pull that cart, but instead we've got the cart in front, and then they're trying to figure out how can you get the horse to push this cart. I mean, that's a little bit what's happening in healthcare, I think, right now,
Yeah. That's a great visual image. And it takes so much more effort to push people along in that way when I think people go into healthcare because they want to see patients. They want to see people get better. They want to be healers. But when that's kind of squeezed out of you, it's really demoralizing or demotivating. And you're not going to, I mean, you might still try to give your best, but you're exhausted and depleted and you just don't have the same maybe energy to give at that point.
And the idea of retreats, at one point retreats were this thing where people would go and they would come back rejuvenated, but now, as our friend Jenny talks about, like, that's not a retreat, that's work, like working retreats. So instead of having fun and being rejuvenated, you're like, well, that just was another work day. But what if we had, in addition to continuing professional education, we had a week a year of continuing human education. And you could, do a meditation retreat. You could learn, have take time to like learn to become a yoga instructor. And you could then bring these things back and share with other people. So I think about that, like, what if we had continuing human education, something maybe like a week a year? Also, too, maybe they've got grand rounds. Why not have, human rounds once a month? You've got something that you go to this thing. Maybe there's some evidence base in it, but you have an experience of being human there. And you're not feeding your mind, you're feeding your heart and your soul. And so you come out feeling fulfilled rather than feeling like, oh, I should really read that article, or there's another book that I better read now, or that was great, but now I feel like I know less than I did before. And, now I've got to figure out a way to implement this. I thought I was doing well. Even this whole like high reliability organization and everything and continual process improvement is like, you could always be doing better. And there's a little bit of that.
It's a preoccupation with failure.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's actually really different than like focusing on relationships out of compassion or humanness and, love or care. Yeah. So can you say just a little bit about how moral injury fits in with all of this and why it matters?
Yeah, so it's interesting. Dean and Talbot, they had that article that came out in Stat a couple of years back, and then ZDog MD. I don't know if you've ever watched the ZDog MD, but if you want to learn about moral injury, just put in your search engine ZDog MD. It's not burnout, it's moral injury. And it's like 6 minutes. There's tons of expletives. It's great,
It's a perfect fit.
Yeah,
for
yeah, yeah. I think people started looking at moral injury because they were like, burnout seems to be saying that it's an individual problem. But it's interesting, if you go back and read Maslach's work, her early work was, this is an issue of a relationship between an individual and an organization. This is an organizational work issue. It's not an individual issue. So very early on, she was looking at that. But I think somehow in the way things have been implemented, burnout seems to be an individual issue, and the way of addressing it is self-care programs rather than change on the institutional side. So I think moral injury really was, at first I was like, I'm a little bit uncomfortable about this, because working with veterans and moral injury comes out of, combat veterans and the moral dilemmas they were put in through combat and also from betrayal from their commands, from the hierarchy and authority. I was like, oh, I don't want to kind of, culturally appropriate something from veterans for physicians and say, oh, poor physicians were burned out. But as I started to look at it, I was like, there's a lot of similarity with moral injury. We're facing life and death. We're trying to care for people. And yet we often feel the institution is not supporting us in it. That our best work is the stuff that we do on secret or extra, running over. That was a great session, but I ran over 10 minutes and now I'm late for the rest of my day is messed up because I did some really good work and then I pay for it later. So this idea of moral injury, I think, does shift from an individual problem to the institution causing it. I don't know that it's totally true. I think when I talked in the beginning about intrinsic and extrinsic, so moral injury is an extrinsic element of clinician suffering that is unnecessary from the institution. But there's a level of necessary suffering that we have intrinsically from working with death and madness and grief and illness and all these different chronic pain, these things that we deal with our veterans or our patients, So I think moral injury can also go too far then and say it's only an institutional problem. At this point, because the balance is so much on the individual, I think it's worth pushing back some. But, I think in a way we need to go beyond burnout. We need to go beyond resilience. We need to go beyond moral injury to, I like what this article says again of somehow, how do we take care of each other? How do we put care back in healthcare? So how do we take care of each other? How and this has to be distributed throughout the system. Accountants need to be caring, HR needs to be caring, leadership needs to be caring, managers need to be caring, housekeeping needs to be caring, frontline staff need to be caring, clinicians need to be caring, everybody needs to be caring, and even patients, peer support, patients could be caring for other patients, and patients are learning self-care in holistic models and whole health models. Caring is the thing that we're trying to teach. And so in some ways, I can turn this around and just say, well, the bigger question is, how did we lose a sense of caring in healthcare? How have we gotten so far from that? And then I suppose the antidote would be, well, how do we bring caring back in?
I mean, it is a challenge because bringing caring in, I mean, it currently, it does have costs. You know, like you have to write your notes on the weekend if you care extra, because it does take extra time. But at the same time, those are the moments that you either care about your colleague or yourself or your patient more. But figuring out how to like have that trickle up or trickle down or just kind of be permeated throughout the whole system and the whole organization.
How do you incentivize caring? Like with the cart and the horse, like if the horse is like, oh, I'm going towards caring, and I'll pull this, it's easier for me to pull this burden because I feel like my caring is supported and valued. I wonder, is there a way in incentivizing caring, even just like, there's so many things that I do in my job and I'm like, oh, that was great, but I better not tell. It doesn't fit in the flow chart or the org charter. It doesn't fit in, in the productivity scheme. So, I don't want to talk too much about that because I have been told, well, you shouldn't be publishing blogs with Johns Hopkins Closler, really you should be doing evidence-based research. How could we support the humanity of people, of all the people within the system, and how can we incentivize caring rather than it being something that's done on the side or as an afterthought? I mean, it's like an institutional change. It's a cultural transformation.
Well, I mean, if nothing else, I love that idea of human rounds.
Yeah.
And caring rounds. And just, time to spend like being people. Actually, I'm going to be interviewing a palliative care chaplain in a few weeks. And I know that she's involved with leading something called Schwartz Rounds, which is focused on processing deaths and bad outcomes and just being present for people, and sounds very human.
Medical humanities, are great too, like writing and art and different things like that. And I guess the thing is, though, they're seen by the institution as something that's not essential. Like, how can we make caring essential, and how can we incentivize continuing human development? Like, to get credit, just like we get credit for so many continuing education hours. I went and presented at a conference. Could we make healthcare a place where somebody, one person says, hey, I went and presented at a conference. Another person says, hey, I got my yoga teaching certificate and I ran my first yoga class, and that those are held in kind of equal esteem.
Celebrating the humanity, the creativity. I wonder if bringing creativity back is pretty critical too.
So it's a big issue. I mean, there's tons of people working on it. I think there's also Deming has a couple of interesting quotes of like, a system is designed to produce exactly, I might be getting it backwards. It's like, a system is designed to produce what it produces. So if our system is producing 50% burnout in physicians, that means the system is produced in such a way to get that outcome. So then we can blame the physicians and say, well, what can we do over here? But if it's the system that's producing that, then we need to figure out how we can change that system. And I'm hopeful in the sense that we've had this whole groundswell of self-care and holistic care and whole health care, all these different things. So there's this great groundswell of this. And all these great tools that people can use to care for themselves. But really, I think it's almost like you got to do it before you're burnt out. Because once you're burnt out, it's like you're not going to be like, okay, now I'm going to enroll in 5 yoga classes and fix my burnout. Dr. Glaucoma Flecken, have you seen his stuff on Twitter? He's got some great stuff. Like if you look at that, like Dr. Glaucoma Flecken and burnout. And so he's this ophthalmologist. He plays all these same roles, or different roles, but it's him, and he'll put on different, costumes and things. But he's got this one where he's leading a meeting, a staff meeting, and he's like, "Okay, people, listen up. You're gonna do this self-care, and you're gonna get rid of your burnout." It's just these spoofs. He does all these great spoofs. But I think, as we design programs, we need to like listen to Z Dog, and we need to listen to Dr. Glaucoma Flecken, and say, is it going to come across that we're just like disingenuous, that we're inauthentic, or that we're blaming people, that people are going to come out of this feeling like, oh, on top of doing all my charts, now I got to do my yoga. And in the kind of thing with Dr. Glaucoma Flecken, the one guy, I forget which specialty it is, maybe dermatology or something, they've always got a scribe. And so then they get the scribe to do the wellness exercises because all the doctors are too busy. They want to catch up on their work.
Ah, you're gonna have a really well scribe. Yeah. I mean, I guess what comes to mind for me is that we really just have to figure out how to get teams, team leads, executives, maybe to start practicing these things in a really realistic, genuine way and figure out how to get people in relationship with each other first and then worry about patient care later. I mean, it's all we, I mean, it's critical. But if we're not caring for ourselves and each other, we're not going to have the ability to do anything that's healing for patients.
There's a book called Patients Come Second, and that's kind of the idea. It's these two CEOs, I think, out of Texas, who basically said they realized, we're not going to get out of our staff what we're not putting into our staff. You can't get out of something what it doesn't have. So, that goes against a lot of models where, patient comes first, customer comes first. But there's that old, kind of a metaphor of like, when the oxygen masks drop down in the plane, you put your own oxygen mask on first and then you help people.
So, last question. How do you keep yourself sustainable in this whole current time, or even in times that haven't been, quite this absurd?
I mean, I do all the self-care stuff. I do yoga. It's been harder during the pandemic. I used to go to the gym more and take walks, walk the dog, make time for just being a well-rounded human being. I used to call it a counter-curriculum. In my first book, I called it a counter-curriculum of rehumanization. So, art, creativity, reading novels, spending time with friends, all these different things, that are to help round you out as a human being. I mean, the other thing that I really have tried to work on is to view things from like a transformational education perspective. So Mesereau talks about transformational learning. And in transformational learning, it kind of mirrors like the hero's journey, Joseph Campbell's hero's journey, or the process of initiation, where you have this separation and initiation return that people go through a transformational experience. And so Mesereau says that transformation starts with a disorienting dilemma. And then the middle of the transformational process is you recognize that the disorientation is part of the transformation. And then you go through the transformation and you come back, sort of, you return transformed. So this is the other thing that I think of, like with the intrinsic elements of burnout, to develop ways of working with pain and suffering for ourselves, to acknowledge them on an emotional level, to acknowledge the reality in our work, and to figure out two kind of like oars, I suppose, if you're using a rowboat metaphor. On the one hand, pain and suffering, pain and suffering, pain and suffering. We're in it all day long. The other hand, though, joy and bliss, joy and bliss, joy and bliss. So how do we cultivate joy in our work? And there's a lot of joy in medicine coming out of the Institute for Healthcare Improvement. A lot of focus on that. How do we bring back joy into medicine? But at the same time, we can't just use that as window dressing and say if we just have people do an hour of joy, continuing joy education once a year, we're going to solve the problem of suffering. So it's kind of like, how can we be real with our suffering, be real with our patient's suffering, and be real with our own suffering? And how can leadership be real with everybody's suffering in the system? And yet, in a way, being real with suffering might automatically help us have more joy. Because if we're all suffering together and we're all pulling together and doing good work together, we can feel good at the end of the day. Whereas if each individual is trying to manage the suffering, you end up feeling less than at the end of the day, because no one's bigger than suffering.
So coming back to that collective.
But if we can figure out, figure out a way to that article again of like, how can we shift suffering from it being an individual's problem to being a collective problem?
Yeah, my current answer for myself has just been to like, okay, how can I not fight this moment? Like, how can I just let this particular moment be a little bit easier? But I guess that has not necessarily connected me in that collective way. It just sort of like eases the intensity of like particularly challenging moments. But I love that idea.
They're similar. I think the acceptance of the suffering creates space for other than suffering to come in. Whereas if you're always just pushing away the suffering, or if you say, I shouldn't be suffering, you know, then if this is one of the narratives I don't like with burnout and the resilience thing of like, if you're resilient, you wouldn't be burnt out. Maybe we should just say, everybody's going to burn out several times during their career. Let's develop a system that expects it, anticipates it, tries to prevent it as much as possible, expects it though, and supports it when it happens. Sabbaticals, you know, that'd be a great time for a sabbatical.
And I know some professions, maybe it's not common anymore, but some professions used to practice that. Yeah. Oh, I love that. Yeah, just allowing for the reality we're human. We can't actually tolerate everything forever. And even, you know, maybe being resilient is also becoming fatigued and recognizing that and pulling out for a while and experiencing like radical self-care and having the compassion to be okay with the fact that maybe we can't, you know, do the standard job right now. And then allowing healing.
But this, though, let's add in radical self-care still makes it an individual thing. Let's call it being radically cared for.
I love that. That's even better.
While you're learning your radical self-care, you're absorbing it in an environment of radical care.
A community. Well, let's work on that, Dave.
Yeah. This is a start. What you're doing now, I mean, you're bringing people together to have these conversations. And that's something, too, that I think we shouldn't expect that if we get rid of the idea that we can prevent it, then it becomes an ongoing process. Just like with continuing education, we don't think, oh, you know, didn't you go to a conference like 2 years ago? You should be good on your continuing education. They're like, no, you need to keep up on it. So with this continuing human education, we need to keep up on it.
Yeah, and always be caring in that radical way for each other. Oh, well, I feel uplifted. I really do. Yeah. Thanks, Dave.
You know what I like that I'd hear you tell patients? Mm-hmm. Let's see, what was it that you'd say? You'd say something like, it was so good seeing you today. What is it? Do you remember that?
I still say that.
Yeah, yeah. But I'd hear it because your office was like down, you know, just kind of kitty corner to mine. And I'd be like, that's so nice. She's so nice. She's so caring. I mean, wouldn't that be great? I wish every time I went somewhere, someone said, you'd say this, it was really good seeing you today. I think that was it. It's really good seeing you today, Nicola.
Oh, it's really good seeing you today too, Dave. Thank you again. I appreciate everything.
Thank you for listening to Menders. If you enjoyed this episode, please take a moment to subscribe, leave a review, and share this episode with a friend. And don't forget to head on over to mendinghealthsystems.com to get started creating cultural transformation for your healthcare team today. Let's create transformation magic.